You also have heard that President Trump had asked for a National Day of Prayer today, and we have engaged in prayer, and we'll continue to. And there are many things to pray about, and it reminds me of Isaiah in asking for prayer for the Israelites in chapter 64, the previous chapter to this. Isaiah had requested audience and a response from God for Israel. He was concerned for the state of the affairs of things at the time, just as we have concern for things in our time. And the context obviously is significantly different, but the concerns are there nonetheless, and we can appreciate that. As far as Israel's situation, Israel was languishing under the effects of divine discipline. And the nations around had been troubling them, and there was plenty more to come. And that's the disconcerting part. We don't know how much more we have yet to face, but we can expect it will be continuing to be interesting, I'm sure. And so the Lord then is going to be responding by indicating why they are properly under his divine discipline. That's what chapter 65 is going to be dealing with. And so we do well to consider as it relates to our nation as well. Does our nation deserve divine discipline? I mean, if Israel did, and we know what we know about them, we can obviously ask the question, does our nation and does the world as a whole, because we know that this event that's going on, and I wouldn't necessarily say it's divine discipline, but it could be part of the bigger picture of the fact that we're in a fallen world and these are the effects that happen. And the question is, how will we deal with it? Because that's what's on everyone's mind right now. And so maybe there are some insights that we can gain as we think about Israel in their context, in their situation, what they were going through, perhaps some spiritual insight for us as well. As we look at this chapter, we see the people of Israel provided ample justification for divine discipline. Their behavior, their responses are sufficient justification for that discipline. But we see it starts off with a contrast when we look at this chapter, a contrast with another people and Israel. So it begins in verse 1, I was sought by those who did not ask for me. I was found by those who did not seek me. I said, here I am, to a nation that was not called by my name. So he's giving a contrast. There's another nation out there, he's giving as an example, that has sought me, but not maybe in the same way, but they had a concern. And then in contrast to that is Israel. I have stretched out my hands all day long to a rebellious people. He went to great lengths to reach out to them who walk in a way that is not good according to their own thoughts. So they were going in a different direction is the idea. So there's a clear contrast between the receptive and rebellious. And I'm going to use a term here, a non-elect nation, a non-chosen people. Israel was the chosen people. This was a non-chosen nation, was noted for being especially receptive. Through Isaiah, the Lord had responded to the earlier prayer, and he replied that he had been gracious in allowing a nation to call on him and to obtain responses from him, since that nation did not normally pray to him. So he's open to them in his grace. And it's interesting, the Apostle Paul uses this verse in Romans chapter 10, verse 20, to refer to the Gentiles. And these were people to whom God responded before they formally called on him. And this was the nation then that Isaiah had in view when he originally gave this prophecy. And it's given as a contrast. This non-chosen nation could still have a relationship with the Lord, which suggests that that chosen idea has different uses. And to pray in God's name means to submit to Him and to pray in terms of His revealed character and will. And even though this nation hadn't formally done that, they had reached out to Him and the Lord responded to them. But in contrast to that, the chosen people were noted for being especially rebellious. The Lord had not hidden His face from the Israelites. He had communicated to them. He had offered Himself to His people. It was not He who needed to change, as they were in their prayer in the previous chapter, seeming to indicate that the Lord needed to get His act together and respond to them. It was the people who had moved in their rebellion. They're the ones that needed to change. They were being rebellious and following their own agenda. And He was not specifically unresponsive and unconcerned, but He was selective as to how He was dealing with them. They wanted Him to work on His terms. He wanted them on their terms, and He wanted them to work on His terms. And so that's part of what's communicated there. And that kind of tends to be the response that so many have today. We want God on our terms. I mean, having God is like having a genie. You know, you just rub the Bible, and God pops up and says, okay, what can I do for you today? What's your wish? Your wish is my command. That's how we would like it to go. But that's not how it is. That's how Israel was acting. That's how people kind of tend to work. That's the name it, claim it, prosperity theology kind of mindset is very much that way. You just kind of rub your Bible, and they don't even actually do that. But they think that, or so it seems. And we can fall into that, or at least people in our day, in our world, can tend to think that way, and we need to be careful of that. So the Lord is basically trying to communicate with them to say, you are my people, and as such, we operate under my terms, not your terms. Then, looking at the next few verses here, verses 3 through 5, a people who provoke me to anger continually to my face, who sacrifice in gardens and burn incense on altars of brick, who sit among the graves and spend the night in the tombs, who eat swine's flesh and broth of abominable things is in their vessels, who say, keep to yourself, do not come near me, for I am holier than you. Oh, where have we heard that before? Actually, it was holier than thou, but we know that came from the King James. So in case you're wondering where that phrase came from, there it is. These are smoke in my nostrils, a fire that burns all the day. So here we have a contrast between right and wrong behavior. The people boldly provoked the Lord to anger. They did so by offering sacrifices in ways that were unacceptable. They did not follow what had been prescribed. They selectively did things. So they would say, well, we did sacrifices, but the Lord had said, you need to do it in Jerusalem in a particular place, and they were doing it in other places, and that was unacceptable. And so when they claimed that He was unresponsive to them, they were really shifting the blame because He was not responding when they were disobeying. And His response was perhaps different than what they were expecting. The people disregarded the Lord's clear expectations. He had communicated that there was a proper place for sacrifice, that formal bricks that were hewn a certain way were not authorized material for an altar. They were to take stones that had not been hewn, that had not had a tool used on them. They also engaged in pagan practices that rendered them unclean. Their involvement in things associated with necromancy and all of that sort of thing. They were not careful to avoid the defilement caused by disregard for God's will. And so the standards that God has given, they were ignoring. And so they were doing things that involved sitting among the caves and spending the night in tombs that were associated with rituals of the cult of the dead and that sort of thing. The necromancy involved contacting the spirits by spending the night in the cemeteries. And we think, well, that's stuff that goes on today. Apparently that was stuff that went on back then as well. And it continues to have some element of popularity at different times and different places. And the very presence in a place of the dead would have rendered them unclean, let alone the involvement in the activities that were associated with those places. So it was a serious infraction on the Lord's expectations. And it provoked him to anger. And so that's just an interesting list of some things there, and it makes us perhaps wonder, at least it causes me to wonder, what may provoke the Lord to anger in our day? If we were to write a list like Isaiah had there, that list, and if we were to think about, okay, what things in our nation today would provoke him to anger, or what things in our lives might provoke him to anger, those are things to contemplate. If you want to exercise sometime, just sit down and think about that and write that out and see what you come up with. The people were full of contempt and arrogance. There was an assumption of spiritual superiority over others. That was this Pharisaical thing that came later. That became a sort of a formalized thing. Didn't start off necessarily bad, but became that way. But the attitude, the disposition, was such that it was not appreciated by the Lord. And it's interesting when we think about that, if you were to go to Matthew 23 and you see Jesus as he is going through a delineation of all the problems he has with the religious leaders of the day, particularly the Pharisees. And he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees." And he just goes down the list of things and says, "You are off track. You think you've got it all together, but you do not. You have the wrong attitude." And instead of their offerings being a sweet aroma in his nostrils, as it were, it was more like if you were by a fire and the smoke is going in your face and you can't see, you can't breathe, and it's unpleasant. And that's the picture that's communicated there. And so the Lord had a problem with the attitude in the mentality. So in all of this, Isaiah was speaking on the Lord's behalf about the Israelites who felt that their rituals of worship should have resulted in God's blessing, or at least he should have responded to them when they prayed, but because of their bad attitudes and their superior disposition, he was basically putting them in their place. And so that's what they needed to be reminded of. And we can fall into the same trap. We can think that we are holier than thou, that we have it together and everybody else is wrong. And sometimes we might be right on some things, but if we develop that arrogant attitude, then we have a problem that is comparable to what is being pointed out by Isaiah here. And we need to deal with that and not be an annoyance to the Lord. So there are some lessons here for us. Take the Lord's expectations seriously. Don't think more highly of oneself than is warranted. course, the New Testament reminds us of that as well. Both attitudes and actions are accountable to the Lord. And the last one, just to kind of reiterate, don't be an annoyance to the Lord. Now you may have had occasions when someone around you has been an annoyance to you, and you don't appreciate that. But how often do we think of ourselves as being an annoyance to the Lord, or these people being an annoyance? That's something we want to avoid, obviously. Then looking at verses 6 and 7, behold, it is written before me, I will not keep silent, but will repay, even repay into their bosom, your iniquities and the iniquities of your fathers together, says the Lord, who have burned incense on the mountains and blasphemed me on the hills. Therefore I will measure their former work into their bosom. And so there's more to think about here. There's a clear indication of recompense for rebellion. The Lord will not keep silent in the face of national rebellion. He's going to deal with this. He announced that this judgment was sure, it was inescapable. The people had demanded that he speak. They wanted a response from him, but I don't think they appreciate what they're getting, as he does, because they thought they had it all together, that they were the victim. Now, we live in a victim society today where everybody's a victim of something. I mean, wasn't it even Harvey Weinstein was communicating that he was a victim? I mean, poor guy. The Lord's word for the rebellious was a word of judgment, not a word of deliverance. They had to deal with, when they were in the wrong, they had to recognize it and had to deal with it. And they didn't want to hear that bad news about their sin. And that's where most of us are. We don't want to hear about that, but we do need to come to grips with it. The Lord is well aware of the iniquities of his people, and the repayment for the sins is necessary, and they had been depending on their position of being chosen people. They had been depending on their rituals, even though they deviated from the specific expectations. They were relying on everything except a personal relationship with the Lord. And there is a danger of that at all times for all of us, where we get focused on the externals rather than the real heart of the matter. And so they had been worshiping Yahweh at mountain shrines, and they had been more scorning the Lord rather than really worshiping him, because they weren't doing as he had asked of them. And so the Israelites were praying that God would come down and listen to them and do what they wanted instead of what they deserved and what he needed to do because of their waywardness. And so that's what is being dealt with here. And then the emphasis is the Lord will repay their iniquity in a personal way. Not just an external, out there, somewhere kind of thing, but it was close to the heart. The reference to the bosom here is a couple of times. This is real close to you. their sin had been personal as well as national, and their punishment and their discipline would be personal as well. That's the point that's communicated here. The Lord has high expectations for his people. He holds them accountable. I mean, these were his people. They were his chosen people. He had revealed himself to them. He had done so much for them throughout the years. And he had expectations for what was to happen through them as well as in them. And yet they were being rebellious, resistant, going their own way, and not being submissive and having the responsive hearts that he wanted of them. And we need to be careful that we don't get focused on our external conformity and not have that heart response that the Lord wants as well. So the Lord provides an inheritance for a national remnant. Verse 8 says, "Thus says the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster, and one says, 'Do not destroy it, for a blessing is in it,' so will I do for my servant's sake, that I may not destroy them all." So the emphasis is there is discipline, a judgment that's coming. But I see within the whole there are some that I'm going to particularly provide for because they have the right disposition. So the Lord indicates that he will preserve a remnant. There is something within the nation worth preserving. So the Lord explains that even though he would destroy the ungodly, that he would also spare the truly godly among his people, those were who were genuinely responsive to him, who had that heart relationship, not just an external conformity. And so he was not going to destroy the whole nation. That's the emphasis of the cluster of grapes, but rather just the sinners among them, the bad grapes, if you will. A portion of the people will not be destroyed in discipline. And the whole nation constituted his servants. They were referred to that way, but most of them were unprofitable servants. And there's going to be a distinction between my servant and you a little bit later when he's going to be indicating those who have this judgment coming upon them. If one were to read chapters 40 through 55 alone, they might come to the impression that all that is necessary to be a part of the remnant is to believe God's promises to deliver. But chapters 56 through 66 make it plain that those who are truly servants of God are those who believe his promises enough to obey his commitment. So there's an expectation for his people to follow through as well. Then coming to the next couple of verses here, verses 9 through 10. "I will bring forth descendants from Jacob and from Judah, an heir of my mountains. My elect shall inherit it, and my servants shall dwell there. Sharon shall be a fold of flocks, and the valley of Achor a place for herds to lie down, for my people who have sought me." Here the Lord indicates that he will provide an inheritance. He will preserve a people from the national lineage. He would preserve a godly remnant from among his people who would inherit his promises. And this idea of a remnant is one that is an important one that sort of continues throughout much of the later part of the Old Testament. As the prophets are communicating how things are going to proceed in the future. The nation as a whole is going to go its own way, but a remnant would be preserved. If we think about the New Testament and the emphasis that's there, it sort of fits that similar mentality. Jesus had said there's a wide road that leads to destruction, and many will go down that road, but there's a narrow road that leads to life, and there are few that make that remnant idea. And it's not hard for us to think about in our own context today, the world in which we live, that there is a remnant of those who truly know the Lord, who have trusted Christ, compared to those who are part of an external conformity of some sort. And that's, I think, helpful to keep in mind. The Lord will provide rest for those who seek him. The faithful who sought the Lord would inhabit a fertile area of the land that's communicated here, the western coastal plain of Sharon, the barren eastern area west of Jericho. It's looking at two sides, the east and the west. and covering the whole gamut there. And that's what they could look forward to in time. Some interpreters regard both the plain of Sharon or Sharon and the Valley of Achor as favorite places in Palestine. They were referenced more than once. And those who sought the Lord were not necessarily those who engage in religious activity, but those who obeyed his covenant requirements as well. The Lord provides stern words for the rebellious majority. That wasn't all that long ago when there was an organization called the Moral Majority. And I think it might be more accurate if we looked at the rebellious majority in our world today. There are more who rebel against God and his plans than those who seek him. But you are those who forsake the Lord, who forget my holy mountain, who prepare a table for Gad, and who furnish a drink offering for many, or many. Therefore, I will number you for the sword, and you shall all bow down to the slaughter. Because when I called, you did not answer. When I spoke, you did not hear, but did evil before my eyes, and chose that in which I do not delight. So here we see those who forsake the Lord are marked for destruction. The Lord knows those who forsake him. He knows those who are his, and he knows those who forsake him. In contrast to the faithful remnant, there are those who forsake the Lord. They did not use Jerusalem as the place of worship. And we remember that when the...